Irreverent, a weekly podcast in which we discuss the Christian faith and how it relates to the great affairs of our time. Welcome, everybody, to Irreverent with me, J.A. Franklin, my good friend T.J. Pelham, who's been having some serious computer issues but has managed to join us eventually. How are you doing, T.J.?
Not too bad. It's one of those typical things. My computer simply stopped working. It's pausing on the login screen and then crashing to a black screen, and I have no idea why. At some point, I will work out.
Yeah, it's 2020, that's why.
It's 2020. I was going to say it's a metaphor for Western civilization, Tom.
Maybe, or maybe I just need a new graphics card, which is what I think is probably the problem.
Tom, all this talk of graphics cards, it's very 90s, isn't it? Don't you think?
I'm a very 90s person. I eschew the laptop, Jamie, and I eschew anything Apple. I have a Tower PC, which I built myself with my own sweat and blood and screwdrivers. So then when it goes wrong, only I have to blame myself, really.
Yeah.
I had to spec my own PSU. It was all lots of acronyms.
Exactly.
Very stressful.
It's probably much harder for the government to spy on you through that as well. I think I've got about 20 Apple products in my house, and I reckon they're listening to me all the time.
I doubt they're listening to you all the time, Jamie, because I suspect you're not that interesting. But maybe if you'd started doing things more outrageous, you will get listened to.
I'm deeply insulted by that. It's good to see you, TJ, finally. The other voice that listeners may have heard is none other than our first American guest, and indeed our first female guest. So I think that probably makes us an intersectional podcast. I don't know what you think about that. And she's also a mathematician, so that's a further kind of minority group, isn't it? So there's a three-way intersectionality there. But yes, it is none other than the female Douglas Murray, Esther O'Reilly. It's so good to have you, Esther. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much. Jamie and I have been having a bit of tea here. You got sound effects. There we go.
That's very, yeah.
Properly British podcast. Oh, it's so does Tom. There we go. Cheers.
Cheers.
I'm envious of your Babylon Bee mug, actually. Thank you.
Well, you can get your own, I think. They don't do international shipping, though.
I don't know if they do. They're not such a big thing over here, but I think they're a wonderful website. Always very funny lampooning of... of all Christians, really, and I think sometimes we need to remember that there's joy in the world.
for sure.
Not take ourselves too seriously, and I think they're very good at that. But they've become certainly more sort of filling that space where the Onion left when it became horrendously, I guess the word is woke, isn't it?
They have. They've sort of got the attention of people like Andrew Doyle over there, other comedians. Who recognize the issues of censorship and that sort of thing. They've definitely been coming through with some funny, fresh election headlines as that craziness continues. So we can use that as a bit of a segue if you like.
I wanted to just say, Esther, just to introduce you a bit more fully, you're a freelance writer, a cultural critic and commentator. I suppose another thing that's very interesting about you is that you use a pseudonym. So Esther's not your real name. I think for listeners who perhaps haven't come across you or indeed listeners who are not really sort of au fait with the academic world, they might be wondering why it's necessary for you to use a pseudonym. I mean, are the things you think so outrageous that you can't say them publicly without some kind of consequences, or could you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, so actually, I came up with this moniker a few years ago when I was very, very young, and just beginning to sort of write columns about hot button political things, and I started writing, fairly strident conservative think pieces. So I was advised at the time, well, you really should, if you want to go on and teach or work in an academic setting, then probably wisest to not put your real name out there. So I did that, and then a few years ago, with kind of concurrent with the rise of Jordan Peterson, I joined the Pathéos blog, and suddenly my writing began attracting much more attention. So I kind of buffed up my platform a bit, and then the name has sort of stuck. But you know, there may come a time I won't say more, but there may come a time when I'm able to sort of integrate, so to speak, and be a little more free to say what I think. But for now, this is my pseudonym. It's what I've had to sort of keep my options open. But yeah, I mean, there's a great concern, and I've got other friends. One in particular I'm thinking of, who's a quite brilliant, promising young scholar, but he's done the same thing as I have. He's taken on a name just to ensure that he'll be able to have all his options open.
Yeah, I mean, I completely understand where you're coming from, and I've spent I spent time at a few universities now, and I guess the thing is, it's just a shame, isn't it, that we live in a situation in which it seems to be that there's increasing levels of censorship and increasing levels of I don't know, danger, I suppose, at speaking your mind and speaking opinions, which, you know, 10 years ago would have been completely normal, you know, completely inoffensive. And, you know, I mean, we're not really talking about that in this podcast as much, but it is just crazy, isn't it? And it's sad that in universities, which are supposed to be, you know, they're supposed to be places where you can experiment with ideas and with new thoughts, that they are in some ways the most dangerous place to share what are, you know, I mean, I've read your stuff, you know, pretty mainstream, small c conservative opinions.
Yeah, it really is a tragedy for sure.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. Well. We've got so much to talk about today. I mean, I was thinking about this, and I think that this has been perhaps one of the craziest weeks I've ever lived through, I would say. You know, it's absolutely insane what's happened over the past week. I mean, since we recorded this podcast, the UK has, a new national lockdown has been announced, and we're now living through the first day of it. So Boris Johnson announced it on Saturday night after a leak to the press, which he says definitely didn't come from number 10 Downing Street. So it didn't come from number 10 Downing Street, but it necessitated an announcement on Saturday evening. He announced that we were going to go into lockdown. Now, I didn't actually watch that broadcast. I don't know whether any of you two did. I mean, I honestly find it so distressing watching these things that I don't even watch them anymore. Did you watch it, Tom?
I did not watch it, Jamie. I must admit, I've not watched a single Downing Street press release in the entire time of COVID. Life is too short, isn't it?
Yeah.
I find it incredibly annoying the way that they wheel out the chief scientific advisor and the chief medical officer. They present some graphs which are clearly intended to terrify people. And then,
and then
after that, they introduce the policy. Theresa May actually had a really good speech in Parliament yesterday, where she said she felt that they were making the science fit the policy after the policy had been agreed, rather than shaping policy by taking the science into account.
That's really interesting, because I don't know a whole lot about Theresa May, but I don't know. I suppose I wouldn't quite have predicted that she would be that countercultural in a way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say that politically her stock is very low, because I think generally speaking, I don't know what you think, Tom, but I think generally speaking, she is seen to have bungled the Brexit thing pretty badly.
She's got no capital to lose, in other words.
Well, I mean, she's still an MP, but she sort of had her time, and she's got her, as a personality, she's very robotic and impersonal and cold, But when sometimes when I listen to her speak, like yesterday, I do think that there is a kind of moral intelligence there. And sometimes she says stuff which, well, I think it was a brave thing to do yesterday. And I think she did the right thing in the House of Parliament, the House of Commons,
I believe she abstained, didn't she, from the vote, which is, I mean, to be honest, Jamie, there's a sense in which she was the wrong leader for the time, that, you know, we needed someone dynamic and fully committed to Brexit, which, of course, Boris Johnson promised to be. And in fair, on the Brexit side, he seems to be. Unfortunately, that sort of dynamism and kind of hasn't helped him in the COVID time when he's been rather bamboozled, what feels.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, because my impression has been that Boris... that Boris had a fan base among people who liked his personality and kind of liked the brashness and whatnot, but that it's like that the fan base has soured because of his hawkish COVID response. You know, is that a good impression?
Yeah, although weirdly, I think in the UK, they're referred to the wrong way around. The doves are the pro-lockdowns and the hawks are the anti-lockdowns.
Okay.
I don't know whether that's... No, don't worry. It's really weird because I'd have it the other way around as well. I would suggest that people pushing for more lockdowns were not the doves. In any case, I think that's fair to say that he's lost a lot of political stock among the people who elected him. I admit to being a supporter of his prior to this event and kind of having to deal with that, I guess.
I'm completely the same, absolutely the same. I voted Tory, I voted Brexit. I will hold my hands up and say publicly that I voted for Brexit and I wanted it to happen. I mean, the way I think about it now, Esther, is that I think Johnson, I'm not sure whether he actually is committed ideologically to leaving the European Union. I wonder whether he did it because he decided that it was his best route into power. Now I think with the lockdown stuff, you know, people are continually saying, oh, you know, he's a libertarian, he doesn't want to do this, et cetera, et cetera. But it doesn't really seem like that, you know. If he didn't want to do this, I think he would either have found another way, or he would have brought us out of it more quickly. I mean, as it is, we're now in the middle of, well, at the beginning, sorry, of a second full-scale national lockdown. So to me, it suggests a kind of ideological torpor, which has been filled with this, by these scientific advisors who have come in. And I don't know how much you know about this stuff with this group called SAGE, who seem to be sort of in control of our government. But they've become, you know, I mean, Ian Duncan Smith called them nakedly political in the way that they leak things to the press. They hold their own press conferences and so on. And I just think Johnson is kind of in their thrall now. You know, he's trapped politically. He can't get out of this. Because every time he does something, like he resisted the scientists for a couple of weeks and said he wasn't going to lock down, and everyone, you know, everyone starts going crazy and say, you know, why aren't you listening to the scientists?
Yeah, it's the same over here. It's with Fauci and whatnot. You know, it's very, very patronizing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess I suppose the significant thing from the point of view of this podcast is that the churches have been so. So what's happened with the churches, Tom? Can you summarise?
I think because we need the context here, really. In the early days of the first lockdown, the churches were, after some confusion, asked to close and close their doors to public worship. And it was after being on an exemption for 1 week, it was removed, possibly after talking to the bishops as an exemption. And the churches legally had to shut down for the whole of Eastertide, for the whole of Pentecost, all the way through till Trinity. We had about 3 months of the churches not meeting and not worshipping in person. And after that, we sort of worked very hard with the government to come up with sort of some compromises, some ways of running the churches that were COVID safe, including not receiving the chalice at communion, which is, I think, a huge compromise, and also not sort of social distancing, masks in churches, no singing, so very stultified sort of worship. And this has seemed to have been successful in that there were no cases that I'm aware of COVID being caught or passed on in a church, which is quite remarkable, really, given that they have elsewhere. And so we were all rather surprised, having received some, we wrote a letter back in September, sort of in asking that the government never shut us down again, and having received a sort of affirmative replies and strong representation from people close to the government saying that would never happen again, to suddenly be shut down with a week's notice again, without any evidence that, that there were any problems going on, no transmission in churches, and so we're back to where we were, really. And I think we're all a little bit disgruntled about that. It's fair enough to say.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You should be.
Yeah, I mean, our last big service. So we had a low mass on Wednesday, but our last big service was on All Souls Day, and I preached the sermon at that service. And I just said to people that really the way I feel about this is quite simply sadness and anger. You know, I'm very, very sad that we can't meet as a church. I'm sad that I won't see a lot of these folks because they won't come they won't come for private prayer for various different, completely understandable reasons. My kids won't be able to go to church anymore. So I just feel a sense of sadness. And then also anger, because I think that this is completely, even if you buy into all of the government strategy and everything, I really don't understand how it makes sense that we're still able to, with all of the measures we put in place, you know, this extreme social distancing and, you know, everyone wearing masks and we can't sing and all this kind of stuff. Even with all of this, we can't meet for communal worship, but we're still allowed to our buildings are allowed to be open for private prayer. I'm trying to think of how to say this, but this decision politically has spiritual significance. You know that
we're
not allowed to meet anymore. We're not allowed to celebrate the sacraments. I mean, I think the same thing about. And this might be a good way of talking about your article, Esther, till we don't have face masks, you know, because for me, this whole thing is, I'm just trying to choose my words carefully. But when you consider the spiritual significance of people worshiping in face masks, not being able to sing, not being able to go near each other, not being able to touch each other. I mean, I had an interview last week with the Archdeacon of Hastings, where he said, if you wanted to weaken the church, this would be a really good way of doing it. You know, so I don't know, Esther, that might be a good way of trying to talk about some of the issues, salient issues.
Yeah. Well, everything you said is so true, and I was rereading this sort of fatuous piece that I was using as a slight foil. I wasn't really, my blog wasn't really intended as a point by point rebuttal of it, but it was just kind of exemplified the sort of response that really gets up my nose of this guy writing and saying, well, we've been worshiping with masks and it hasn't been any hindrance to worship at all. And I'm thinking, okay, it's sort of odd, you know, and I think your instinct is perfectly right. It's like, I mean, like, how do you sing with a mask? I mean, you can kind of do it, but it's not, it's strange. It's this strange alien thing. It was like, this is not how it was meant to be, you know?
Are you allowed to sing? We can't sing here.
Yeah. So of course, you know, things vary state by state. In my own particular state, we're Well, of course, my own church, I attend a tiny Anglican church on the wrong side of the tracks where we have fewer than 10 people in our congregation anyhow. So, it doesn't really, it's sort of a moot point in my particular case. But yeah, we are allowed to sing in my state. So that's not an issue here. But many other places, there are stricter restrictions, many other states and counties. And that varies widely, of course.
Yeah. I mean, I was speaking to just a lady dropped some friend of ours who's lives locally, but she dropped some food off for us this morning, and she goes to a charismatic evangelical church, a big church, big by our standards, hundreds of people, and they were able to have one meeting back before this new lockdown, and she was saying how. You have like the worship leader behind a perspex screen. Everyone's in masks. They're not allowed to sing, and so the worship is
in a charismatic context. That's like, especially.
Yeah, I know. What she was saying, she's they're all just sort of raising their hands and humming behind their face masks, and I
can picture it. Yeah.
Bizarre, isn't it? It's kind of kind of dystopian, isn't it? The whole thing.
And it's a strange idea that this is sustainable even in the short term. It's just wrong. And you find some people who seem to think that this is how we're going to live for the next 5-6 years. And you think this is
exactly
madness.
Yes, thank you. It is. And I mean, if I can just vent a bit here, I've had people say, well, I mean, look. If everyone just complied perfectly, this would all be gone in, checks notes. Well, we're not sure exactly when this would all be gone. We'll get back to you on that, but if everyone has to comply perfectly, and it's like, it's this open-ended thing. It's like, we can't. Like, there has to be you can't just sort of endlessly say, well, this is just the new normal. We should all just sort of cheerfully accept this. It's not sustainable,
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the one of the things that scares me about that kind of thing is it's almost like, people like this, and they think that this is, this is some kind of positive development in society. And I don't, to be fair, I don't know, I would say I don't really know very many Christians who are like this. I mean, to be fair, I haven't really spoken to many people face to face over the last 8 months. But I guess this idea that this is the way things are now, and this is the way things should be. Like this kind of the mask as a symbol of public virtue. I mean, we see this with Biden is never ever pictured without a mask. It's like the ultimate kind of virtue signal, isn't it?
And I mean, what kills me is like, if you had asked these people, a year ago, what possible downsides could there be in a society if we instituted these various mandates, the distancing, the masking, could we think of some? We could have made a list, but it's like suddenly now we're not allowed to really talk about those or weigh those seriously without being called grandma killers or whatnot,
absolutely. I'd like to just read out this email from Austin. So thanks for getting in touch, Austin. He thanks us for the podcast and says it does feel very lonely being someone who's grieved by the way the crisis has been handled by the government and by the church. The church has acted with keenness to demonstrate how much they care about stopping COVID-19. It's been less keen to point out the distinctive aspects of church, which mean that it cannot be treated as if it were equivalent to a chain of cinemas. Says he's 39 and he's been involved in churches since he was a child, serving in various roles. I enjoy fellowship and communion with others who are very different to me, who I would never otherwise have met, especially in individual conversations after church. I'm dismayed to see how my local church is disintegrated, replaced by a video conference and a YouTube channel, annoyingly described in C of E corporate speak as new ways of doing church. Having joined our church last Christmas, we hadn't got to know many people when the first shutdown happened. I've attended the dwindling Sunday service 3 times since the first closure, and on each occasion I almost cried at how cold and clinical everything was. I thought about Christians in other countries who risk their safety to worship together or even risk imprisonment or persecution. Our son has severe autism, and this year has been a nightmare for our family. His problems are many, but he always loved church, sitting next to the band and joining in the music. He always found church quite calming, reducing his anxiety. There is no way he can engage with online church. It makes no sense to him at all. There must be many with disabilities which make online church impossible. I've tried to engage with church since March. Our family has in different ways, but we haven't been able to make it work. We can't get around the fact that the relationships we once had with others are more distant and more shallow. There is a new awkwardness because most people are frankly scared to talk face to face. I really don't know what to do about it. And then he basically raises at the end of his email the question of what the church should do as a response to this, whether and when it would be right to start to resist some of these measures. And he ends by saying, I hope we will at least have more church leaders willing to challenge and question what is happening. Best regards, Austin. But I read that.
That breaks my heart, man.
Yeah. It's so sad for him and his it's hard for people. I've got three young children. It's hard for children anyway, yeah. particularly with children with autism. And I guess, you know, sort of from an ecclesiological perspective, you know, this really illustrates how this isn't, this is not, you know, what's going on at the moment is not acceptable because it's exclusive, you know, and this is a fundamental ecclesiological principle that the church is for everyone, regardless of how old they are or their background or their abilities and so on. And this, you know, this way of church, it doesn't matter what people say, it is exclusive to people who have disabilities or people who are very young or people who are very old. It excludes people from the body of Christ. And I was thinking about this earlier, and I guess the way I'd characterize it is to say, you know, that this is, in a sense, we still have access to the center, you know, those of us who can attend church, we still have access to the center and we can still receive the sacrament, albeit in this sort of weird way. But we're not connected any longer to one another, if that makes sense. We've been disconnected and atomized from each other. So we can meet, but we can't connect with each other. And from a, you know, from a Eucharistic perspective, I'm always drawn by the idea that the Eucharist is something that creates the church. You know, it turns the church into the body of Christ, members of one another. And you know, it seems to me that in the current situation, that key aspect of the church is entirely entirely precluded, really.
Mm. Yeah, that's a very, very good way of putting it.
Yeah.
I delved into a bit of a Twitter minefield the other day, and because a friend of mine commented on something which he saw, which is a group of clerics, mostly Church of England, but a variety of other ones, who were actively saying, no, we should shut down the churches. We really ought to, not just to follow the law, but because it's a good thing to suffer alongside everyone else, people in gyms. Why should we have special treatment? And I was kind of upset to see that. I'd have been upset to see that from a secular person, but to see it from a minister in the church kind of appalled me. And I just wanted to talk about, you know, this is all reminding me of that, because, you know, we're not dealing here with things that are equivalent of, you know, going to the pub for a pint of beer, or what's the American version of that? I don't know, going to Starbucks for a coffee.
We have pubs too, but
yeah, of course you do. But I mean, you don't have beer, do you? And so that's sort of, no. proper black stuff. And and the point is that we're not here just dealing with a social group. We're not just dealing with, a community, but there's something deeper and more fundamental going on than that. And it's not in the same category as a leisure activity or even as an educational activity. And it's quite rightly given its own sort of space in the sort of human right legislation and laws, distinct to sort of all the other things, because it is not just something that Christians like to do. It's something that Christians need to do in order to be church, in order to be ecclesia. And you cannot be, ecclesia being the Greek word for gathering, of course, you cannot be a Christian without a church. The idea that you can just sort of go it alone, sit in your own room and gather there. I mean, obviously, if you haven't got anyone else, yeah, that's one thing, and Christ will be with you. But that's not a state of being that can be tolerated.
Yeah, right. And I mean, just before we go to a quick break here, I've seen people say, well, this is about, the Bible says to submit to the governing authorities. And I'm thinking, in nowhere does the Apostle Paul say that if the governing authorities say that you cannot gather to worship, you have to submit to them. That's not a thing the Apostle Paul says. So it seems like a gross misapplication of scripture there.
Yeah, I mean, the Bible also says greet each other with a holy kiss, doesn't it?
And I like that. Yes, very good point.
I think this time around, I do want to say that I think the situation, at least in the Church of England, seems to be a little bit different. I was very pleased to see that the two archbishops and the Bishop of London, I think did they compose a letter together, or was it the two archbishops?
It was a good letter, and do you know, well, better letter than previous attempts, in as much as it made the very, very good point that all of, because the church's sort of outward functions in some ways have remained the same. So if you're running a food bank, you can still run the food bank, you can still do charitable works. And they made the point that the church isn't just sort of a charity with sort of spiritual leanings, but rather that the works of the church flow from its primary function of giving God the worship and honor that God is due. And that is why we, you know, we're not sort of social workers with a little bit of ritual thrown in. We are people who are doing the primary function of humanity.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And if I can add another element, there's the sacramental element of the consecration and giving of communion, which, you know, personally, I would say you can't substitute on a Zoom call. You know, like I've seen people talk about, oh, yes, we took communion by Zoom today. The priest just sort of communicated everyone in an empty building. And it feels so wrong. I just don't think that's appropriate or acceptable as a substitute.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, the issue there is about the church's Catholicity, obviously speaking, you know, with a small c. Hi, Sarah. I mean, I remember reading a very, very strong article by Rowan Williams. I forget where it is exactly, but he's talking about the way that, you know, the early church epistolary tradition, the reason that this developed in the way that it did was because, because of the high value that the early church placed on Catholicity, which basically means connection. You know, it's about Christians being connected to each other physically, you know, in the same proximity as each other.
And yes,
so you have people traveling the length of the then known world on foot, bearing a letter from one church to another. And, you know, St. Paul often talks about, you know, how people were risking their lives to in this activity of transporting these letters. But the point being that such a high value did they place on that sense of physical personal presence between one group of Christians and another. It says something very deep about the church's Catholicity. And that's something that I think is really important when it comes to the sacrament as well. It's one of the principal meanings of the sacrament, I would say, is that it unites believers together, as I was talking about earlier. And that is a very literal, physical thing. It can't be done remotely with the same with the same significance. And you know, it's the same thing with things like ordination as well. You know, how in the early church you would have three bishops at any ordination. It's all about Catholicity and connection with one another. So and really that's one of the principal theological problems with social distancing is it's completely anti-Catholic in that sense. It's all about disconnection and atomization and isolation, completely the opposite of what it's all about.
Right. Whatever happened to no man is an island, you know.
I remember it was when I was doing the BCP Eucharist a few months back, which is the old Book of Common Prayer. If there are any American listeners, 1662, and the reading was that wonderful one from Mark where Christ heals the blind man by spitting on the ground, taking the dirt and rubbing it in his eyes. And I said, look, you know, there's something physical about, such a physical thing about the incarnation. Can you imagine doing that now?
yes.
Even before COVID, you know, healing someone's eyes by spitting on the floor, rubbing that mud into their eyyes. This cannot keep going.
I saw somebody saying, you know, if Jesus were around today, Jesus would not be social distancing. You know, he would be getting close to patients to, you know, to heal them. Very good analogy.
And it's not hard to, you know, well, it is hard to remember maybe sometimes that back in first century, there were plenty of deadly infectious diseases that were killing people. You know, it's not as if he was living in a, you know, leprosy and various other ones, you know, but there were real deadly diseases around and no modern healthcare. But the other thing I just wanted to say was this, the response that a lot of people who want the churches to shut down would come back to is, but God, they say, you know, the killer blow, but God says to love our neighbour, we need to love our neighbour by shutting the churches down. And I think this is getting things the wrong way round.
Yes, it is.
In as much as how do we most love our neighbour? By sharing the love of Christ. How do we best share the love of Christ? It's by demonstrating how we properly order our lives towards God and bringing them into that order. Not by sort of saying, actually church is irrelevant and unnecessary to being a Christian, but actually by witnessing that church is essential to being a human.
Absolutely.
I get upset.
Yeah, no, amen to that for sure.
Yeah,
I mean, it reminds me, Tom, I don't know whether you read that book called The Widening Circle by Graham Tomlin, which is about priesthood. It's about you know, the way that you know, humanity was originally called to be a kind of herald of God's glory in creation, and the fall has disrupted that, which means that, well, it necessitates firstly the church to be a herald to humanity, to fallen humanity, but then also it necessitates the priesthood as a kind of herald to the church, if you like. So you've got like these kind of, that's, you know, the widening circle is that image of you know, one circle, if you like, proclaiming to another God's glory, going outwards and outwards and outwards, you know, eventually into all of creation. And so that idea of a human being at his or her highest, being a priest, essentially, you know, a herald of God's glory, that is the end for which human beings were created, and to imply that you know, something that's absolutely central to the telos of humanity, i.e. the church and the priesthood and the sacrament, somehow you can kind of turn them on and off, and you know, that'd be a good thing, it's really it's just very problematic, isn't it? It doesn't really, from a Christian perspective, it doesn't really make any sense. I just think the only way it makes sense is from a kind of secular utilitarian perspective, where you don't.
Yeah.
Sorry, Esther, do you want to come in?
Well, yeah. And I mean, I was just going to say too, you know, the way people speak about this, you'd think we were talking about bubonic plague or cholera or, you know, like one of these, or Ebola, or one of these things that you know, that like devastates a community and leaves everybody dead. You know, it's not. That's, we're not even talking about something like this. We're talking about something where, you know, even old, vulnerable people have recovered from. I mean, not all, of course, and that's a tragic loss for sure. But it, you know, there's not a good sense of perspective here. And I saw a guy, I saw somebody writing about this who was comparing it to so there was a group of Christians in Moscow, Idaho, who staged some civil disobedience, and a few of the members were arrested for it. So this writer was, you know, kind of subtly, you know, expressing some disdain for this. And he was comparing it to people rushing through town on motorcycles at 100 miles per hour. Mm-hmm. That this was like the equivalent of what they were doing in breaking the mask mandates, that it was that dangerous, you know, it was that reckless as far as, you know, not caring for human life. And it's just no sense of proportion there.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Esther, let me ask you this, because this is a question I think is really important. We've kind of talked about this a little bit before, but yeah, if you take that view, and I think it's fairly safe to say that Tom and I are probably, you know, pretty much on the same page as you. It's clearly the reaction that we've seen in the Western world is clearly disproportionate, and in many ways, just, you know, it's, I don't even know how to describe, I just think it's crazy. I think it's absolutely crazy what we're doing. It's you know, it's not an exaggeration to say that we are economically bankrupting ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're going to plunge ourselves into depressions the likes of which we've never known. And, you know, it could be that in the very short term future, China is the world's superpower, far richer than any European country, far richer than the US. And we've done it all to protect ourselves from a virus using, you know, dubious measures, which have really no evidence that they work, in order to protect a very small group of vulnerable people. Now, we're not being heartless in saying that. The issue is that it's a disproportionate reaction. We didn't need to do this in order to protect people. We could have protected the vulnerable people without doing this. And that's what, I'm sure you've seen the Great Barrington.
Oh, yes. And I mean, there's so many factors here. I mean, so give you an example, so that there was an article in the Scientific American recently that was trying to debunk claims that COVID deaths are being overcounted. And so there was a case of a woman, I think, who had chest pains, but she was afraid to go to the hospital and wound up dying of cardiac arrest. And so then that was sort of counted as a COVID-related death, which seems incredibly disingenuous to me, because it's like, the reason she was afraid to go to the hospital was because of the, you know, the kind of mass hysteria around the virus. That's really not.
Yeah.
It's just disingenuous. And there's so many people who've missed, you know, cancer screenings and important appointments for other kinds of health conditions, yeah, because the hospitals have been, you know, have been canceling things. There's so many ways in which these regulations have done more harm than good. And then there are all the mental health considerations. The letter you read from Austin, his son who has autism, that's a serious consideration. And then you've got older adults who are isolated and alone, who've got nobody. There've been suicides recorded as a result of all this. So it's just, I'm sorry, but the loss of life considerations are not all on one side in this.
Yeah, and Esther, what I was going to ask is, given all of that, and I think we're on the same page, what is driving this response? Because to me, it seems like Western civilization is almost primed for something like this to happen. It almost, you know, looking back on it, this has probably almost happened several times before, you know, certainly with the swine flu, and I think it was in 2009. But what is it about our culture that's created this reaction? Do you have any thoughts on that? What is the deeper issue?
I, I think there's a terror. I mean, there's a fear of death, and just a sort of a desperate desire to control, to control the timing of one's own death. And you know, it's interesting because I've heard people, even more conservative people, suggest, well, if we could just shelter the vulnerable and then allow the rest of us to get on, that would be good. But I would actually want to maybe press a little bit on even that notion, because if you asked a good many of those vulnerable people, those, you know, older people, higher risk people, I think many of them would say that they would actually rather take the chance in order to see their loved ones, and that, you know, it's like, if I die, I die. You know, I take the adventure that Aslan sends, to quote C.S. Lewis at Chronicles of Narnia, you know. And I mean, I can say, like, I visited, I wrote in Plough magazine about an old neighbor of mine who's in an old folks home now. We visited her a couple of times since the pandemic, and I wrote about one visit. And, you know, she doesn't really understand what's going on in the outside world. You know, she just knows that she can't eat in the main hall with everybody else because of this thing, coronavirus. Have you heard of it? We're like, yes, Dorothy, we've heard of the coronavirus. And she's like, and my sons can't come to see me anymore. You know, so I've digressed slightly, but it's this, I think, the desperate urge to control and the horrifying notion that there might be something that's beyond our control, you know.
Yeah, I mean my you know, I think you're exactly right. And I was going to say, I was just looking for it in your article. I can't actually find where it is. But in your article, you talk about this ostensibly socially distanced. Is it like a worship event or something with senior citizens? And
oh, right. Yes. I long ago, the way back, I wrote quite a bit about Southern gospel music. And so my mother and I went to see a gospel men's trio singing outdoors somewhere. And their demographic is, you know, squarely in the, like, over 60 range. So that was mainly the people who were there. And, you know, so they were advised to be distanced and to mask up and that sort of thing. And that, I mean, really just wasn't happening. You could see just looking around, everyone had their lawn chairs out and were mingling and not masking. I made the crack that masks were distributed with the approximate density of supporters at a Biden rally, you know. There's a gospel song called Because He Lives written by Bill and Gloria Gaither. And, you know, people were like putting their hands up in the air and singing along with this. And it was just incredibly moving to see these mostly unmasked faces of people participating in this act of worship. And, you know, it's like these people are clearly signaling that they've made their choice, you know, that they would rather have this and take their chances, you know.
I mean, I find that very, very moving, I have to say.
Yeah, it was. It was moving.
Yeah. And you know, it makes me long for the time when we will be able to worship freely again. I mean, I don't, at this stage, it is very, very unclear when that will be. But, you know, it seems to me that, you know, it's a bit like what I was talking about earlier, isn't it? That's what God created us for, is to worship Him. And, you know, that I mean, I have spent a lot of time in charismatic churches. And even though I'm, you know, in more of a high church setting now, I still find that, you know, that kind of emotional, abandoned worship. I think there's something very, very beautiful about it. And particularly in this context, and particularly when it's the kind of demographic that you're talking about. It's very moving, very, very moving. I enjoyed your article in general, Esther. One of the things I wanted to ask about is And I'll just for all our listeners, this is an article Esther wrote, which I referenced earlier. It's called Till We Don't Have Face Masks. I suppose it's kind of Esther's kind of take on the pandemic response in general. And I'll definitely put it on the show notes for anyone who's not come across it yet to read. And I do recommend it. But something I wanted to ask you about, Esther, is a bit about the church's response in America, and particularly this thing with John MacArthur. So could you say for our listeners, you know, who is John MacArthur and what's been going on there? I'm really interested in that.
John MacArthur is a well-known conservative Protestant pastor working in Los Angeles, I believe. It has a church, Grace Church in California, has sort of become a focal point of this because they've reopened and begun sort of consciously stepping over certain lines. And so then his case is going to the courts, and as usual with these things, it's going to take a while to work its way through. And so, you know, he's just sort of calmly but firmly taken his stand and said, you know, that this is not acceptable, much like many of the same kinds of things you guys have been saying here. The church cannot be the church and fulfill its telos and carry out its duties under these restrictions. And so it's generated a huge amount of controversy, including other Christians who believe this is not Christian, you know, who believe he's being reckless and it's a political stunt and what have you, you know. So I am quite firmly in his camp on all this. I think he has at this stage, he has the right approach.
Yeah. Yeah. And have many church leaders in the US done similar things? Have any, or is he the only one?
I mean, he's definitely off the top of my head. He's the most high profile one that I could think of. I'm sure there are a number of, you know, people who aren't household names who are quietly doing much the same thing. But I mean, he's kind of become the most visible person to do that. I mentioned earlier that there've been a couple of places like in Moscow, Idaho, where you had a group of people gathering to sing psalms, a few of whom were arrested. So that church was also a hot spot of controversy. And yeah. I believe there was something in an incident in Nashville as well, but I'd have to go refresh my memory on that.
Yeah. I mean, I find it, one of the things I found, I guess, surprising about this whole thing is how little dissent there was, particularly, you know, when things first started up. I mean, it was almost kind of ubiquitous acceptance of the, you know, of what was going on, and including in the church as well. I've had a couple of emails, just to say, I've had a couple of emails kind of raising this, raising these kind of issues. I've got one from, I think it's Derek, who talks about, well, he basically is asking these kind of questions. And let me just read some of this out. So he's referencing our episode from last week. And he says, in last week's episode, you touched on the suggestion that the church may have to move underground, which echoed something I've been thinking about recently. In the face of an order to close, should churches defy the state and stay open? After all, we are commanded not to forsake the assembling of ourselves together. And Peter in Acts chapter 5, verse 29 says we must obey God, not man. He gives the example of Daniel and his friends when they refused to stop praying. And then he asks other, you know, similar questions, basically around that, you know, that kind of thing. You know, when is the time for the churches to engage in, if this continues, some kind of civil disobedience? And I also had an email from a friend of the show, Rowena, who basically says the same thing. I think this is such a big issue. I mean, we'll have to do another show about it. I think Rod Dreher's new book, which is called
Live Not by Lies, fantastic book, which I owe Rod a review. Sorry, Rod, if you listen to this, I haven't got around to it yet, but I shall. I promise.
I've started reading it. I think it's unbelievably prescient. I mean, it's crazy. It's crazy. It's like he wrote it, and then it's all just coming true.
I know. It's an odd time capsule too, because he finished drafting it in February, March, I think. And so there's just like a couple of hints of reference to the pandemic, but you can tell that it was finished pretty early in the year before all of this had happened, you know. And of course, now he's just like, "Well, everyone buy my book, you know, it's happening, you know."
Absolutely, absolutely. And that might be a good segue, Esther, because we're obviously talking about all this stuff. But I mean, the reason we were going to have you on initially at this time is to come and talk to us about what is going on in the US in terms of the election and politics and the church and Christianity. And, you know, we've just had the US election, and it was on, when was it? It was only a few days ago.
Yeah.
And it's still not over yet. So what's going on? It's absolutely crazy. Well, I mean, we're recording this just to say on Thursday, I think it's the 5th of November today, isn't it? You know, what's going on, Esther? I mean, you know,
well,
in your country?
Yes, I've just refreshed my Google in case it's changed in the last 5 minutes. But it's, I mean, there's various colorful phrases I could use to describe this, but they're not quite fit for this sort of a podcast. But it's crazy.
I could put an explicit box for this one episode, but yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. It's madness. It's absolute chaos. Everyone's high-handed predictions have sort of gone out the window with this. I mean, people thought Biden would win in a landslide. That hasn't happened. I'm sure there were people likewise who thought Trump would win in a landslide. That's not happened. The demographics are just chaos. I mean, if you look at the breakdown of where the candidates make gains and losses, Trump lost ground with white men, gained ground with Latinos and Black voters, and the highest demographic was married women for Trump. So I mean, it's just like all of the woke assumptions are just out the window, and I mean, it really emphasizes more than ever that America's chattering classes really do live in a bubble. That they're completely disconnected from where the country is actually at.
So I've got a couple of questions, because I don't know much about the American sort of system, and I'm not certain that a lot of English people or British people do, because it's quite complicated.
It is very, yeah.
So as of at the moment, as I understand it, Trump could still win, but it's quite unlikely that's going to happen. Is that just outright?
Yeah. It's so as I'm looking here at my refreshed, so maybe I better explain like a little bit, like with the popular vote, the electoral college, what that all means. So each state is represented by its own electoral college, and it varies how many people are on that state to state. And so you can get odd situations where a candidate actually wins more of the popular vote, just like more warm bodies circled in that candidate's name versus the other candidate. But if the candidate were to lose enough states that had a lot of people on its electoral college, the candidate could still lose the electoral vote, and that's what ultimately determines who becomes president. So there's some key states that we call battleground states, because they've got a big juicy bunch of electoral college votes. So Ohio is one of these, Florida is one of these, Michigan, Wisconsin, and currently Pennsylvania is hotly contested. So Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Georgia. So it's so razor thin that even with only four states left to be called, it's still too close to call. So 270 is the magic number. If you've got that many electoral votes, then you win. So Biden is sitting at 264 right now, and Trump is at 214. So it is kind of tilting Biden at the moment. Of course, that hasn't stopped Trump from prematurely declaring victory and throwing a classically Trumpish tantrum about everything. And there has been, you know, suspicious stuff going on. There have been weird mistakes, things miscounted. You know, at least one county I know of that was heavily pro-Trump in 2016, now all of a sudden heavily pro-Biden. So, yeah. You know, it's, yes, sure, there could be just sheer incompetence and negligence going on in the counting process, but there's an awful lot of it, if so. And it really wouldn't surprise me at all if there was somebody's thumb on the scale somewhere in all this mess.
Yeah. So this is mail-in votes of the issue, aren't they? And they're kind of, because when I woke up in the morning, was it yesterday? I can't even remember. You know, Trump was favourite suddenly, which is a bit of a surprise. And then the mail-in votes have been coming in, and they're heavily Democratic, are they not? And sort of in the UK, we have a problem in some areas where mail-in votes are fraudulently filled out. So a sort of Tower Hamlets, I believe, there was an investigation that found that, you know, people were collecting mail-in votes from a house, filling them out on behalf of the people, mailing them in. Is that being alleged, or is there actually any evidence for the sort of the idea that it's being illegally stolen by the Democrats, or is that simply Republican rage?
Yeah, well, I should be careful, because if I'm being honest, I've tried to keep my head in some other things this past election week. So I haven't been coming through quite as obsessively as I could have to give super detailed answers to your questions there. But, you know, it certainly, the mail-in voting has definitely thrown an extra layer of chaos over all of this. So I'm not in a good position to say definitively what's going on there. I'd have to look into it more myself. But I just wouldn't be surprised, and I tend to, you know, when people kind of hasten to fat check these things or hasten to say, oh, the latest Republican outrage, I'm just not terribly impressed by that. I'm just like, well, you know, maybe it is and maybe it isn't. I want to see for myself and see how it looks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Esther, I'd like to ask you about your take on this, you know, from a Christian perspective. So again, I you sent me an article which I think is called How Now Shan't We Vote?
Yes.
And I'll include this on the show notes for anyone who wants to read this article. It's a very good article. But I think you are basically explaining in this article that it was your intention not to vote for either candidate, and explaining your rationale as to why. Do you want to say a little bit about that and kind of explain what your take is on the whole thing?
Yes, this is the position I've had for a while, that the Christian doesn't have a moral obligation to vote, although he might have a moral obligation not to vote for certain candidates. But there, you know, there are people, friends of mine, and I just respectfully disagree with them there, who voted for Trump because they thought that they had to. It was their Christian duty to vote for, you know, one or the other major party candidate, and they had to go with what they saw as the lesser of two evils. So that's not my philosophy of voting. That's not what a vote is to me. To me, when I vote for somebody, I'm asking myself, you know, could I have a yard sign for this person without embarrassment, you know, without shame? Could I be proud of my vote for this person? And I never want to just pull the lever in a purely calculating, pragmatic sense, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, I mean, I think one of the things you say in your article is that voting for someone is kind of a sort of pledge of fealty. Is that what you say? Something
along? Yeah, I like that. I was listening to a podcast discussion where another writer kind of put it that way for herself. And I think that's a nice way of thinking about it. You know, it's a different way of putting what I was saying about, you know, feeling like I can really get behind this person. You know, I can really be proud of, positively proud of a vote for this candidate, you know.
Okay. I mean, I definitely see where you're coming from. I mean, in the situation in the UK, if there were a general election right now, I definitely wouldn't vote either Conservative or Labour. But I think in normal circumstances, I have to say I am quite swayed by the idea of voting for the lesser of two evils. And I think, you know, one of the really interesting things is that you talk about John Piper's article, which we spoke about that on the show last week. So hopefully listeners will at least be aware of it. But I think Piper's argument, which you criticize him in your article, so I'm not equating the two arguments, but his argument is basically that both candidates are awful for different reasons. And, you know, he's sort of saying, well, you know, Trump is kind of, you know, boastful and, lustful and I can't remember what else he says about Trump, but basically, you know, he's got a very bad character and it's, you know, that these things are sinful and they're condemned in the New Testament and so on. And then he contrasts that with, or at least he draws an analogy between that and Biden and saying, you know, Biden is, you know, pro-abortion and he's, you know, probably an authoritarian and there are various other anti-Christian ideologies that he stands for, you know, in the areas of human sexuality and so on. And so I guess Piper's conclusion was that you shouldn't vote for either of these people for those reasons. But it seems to me, and I'd be very interested to hear your take on this, it seems to me that when you can compare those two things, the consequences for society of voting for somebody who is, you know, just to take one issue alone, very pro-abortion, the immediate or medium-term consequences seems to me that they would be very much worse if you had someone like that in office than somebody who was, boastful and arrogant and, doesn't live up to a Christian standard of sexual purity or whatever it might be. And so on that basis, it doesn't seem really unreasonable to me to say that it would be, okay to vote for that person.
Yeah. And I mean, it wasn't so much the ultimate conclusion that I disagree with. It was how he got there. And, you know, it's very odd things that Trump, by his bad character, is killing just as many people as Biden would. And you know, spiritual death is worse than physical death. And I want to say, well, okay, yes, in the abstract, but it's as if he's ascribing all of this enormous power over souls to Donald Trump specifically and personally, as if Trump is directly dragging, you know, as many souls to hell with him as babies who would be aborted with continued funding from Planned Parenthood, you know. And it's like, there's really no comparison there. That's just blown way out of proportion. I mean, yes, Trump does play on people's worst impulses. And you know, yes, there are people who, you know, I would say have been corrupted to some extent by supporting Trump, including some Christians, I think, sadly. But it's just this way out of proportion thing to say that it's just as deadly and to like camp on that. It's like, no, that there is nothing to choose as far as deadliness goes between either of these two candidates. I'm like, well, that's just not true. It's really not.
Yeah, absolutely. I shared with you both a rather interesting email that I received from a listener called Michael. And it's quite a long email, so I won't be able to read the whole thing. But it starts with some nice comments, and then he says he took exception to some of the comments we made last week about President Trump. The assertions were made that President Trump is sexually immoral, unrepentant, and is a terrible choice for president. I think the statement was even made at one point that he came from or has a poisonous wound. Now, we definitely didn't say that. Now, you know, I don't know where that has come from, but I think just to clarify, we've never said that Trump came from or has a poisonous wound. He carries on, "These are all highly insulting comments, the president, and in my view, completely without merit." Okay, and so he says, he points to a piece by James Dobson in the New York Times, where Dobson apparently says that he has personal knowledge that the president gave his life to Jesus shortly before he took office. And there are a number of links in this email. I'll provide some of them in the show notes, maybe not all of them, but there's a link to the New York Times. He asks on what basis these comments about sexual immorality and unrepentance were made. Were they made from evidence about his actions before he was president, or were they made from evidence about his actions during his term in office? If they're made about actions from before he took office, you know, he says, you know, he's a work in progress and we should give grace to him, and that he could have essentially come to know forgiveness from Christ. And then he says, if they're made from evidence after he took office, could you back up that these claims? And then he says, it's my view that the president realized that he was God's man and did give his life to Jesus shortly before he took office. We should honor that and treat him as any brother in Christ that has done wrong in the past, but God has forgiven. Just because he has his own personality and is a baby Christian does not give any of us the right to presume how God sees him. He has opposed abortion, has regularly had church leaders lead spirit-filled prayer at the White House and at other important political events, and he's proclaimed God and Jesus to the masses. God then blessed his actions, and before the pandemic broke, America had the most booming economy on record. This was as a direct result of the strategies that he had put in place, and in my view, was a blessing from the Lord. In summary, to say that he is a terrible choice to have is seriously unmerited, in my opinion. Opposition to abortion, prayer in the White House, the Bible back in schools, proclaiming the name of Jesus. There is no other leader in the Western world that comes anywhere close to what the president is doing to promote Christianity and its values. And then he gives a number of links to back up those claims. So I don't know. What do you think? What is your reaction to that?
Oh dear. I remember that thing that Dobson said about his being a baby Christian and all that. I can remember at the time sort of writing and tearing my hair out over this, because it was just, it was clear then, and it's still clear now that Trump is just, he knows which side his bread is buttered on. And he knows that he's got a base. He knows he's got people who are, you know, sort of in the tank for him. Yeah. So he's kind of saying certain things to appeal to it. Now, I mean, as far as opposing abortion, like is he personally against it? My guess would be that like many people, Trump is ambivalent on it personally. And he certainly doesn't have the ideologues, sort of frenzied support for it. So, you know, he's willing to do certain things with his executive power that lean pro-life. And I mean, that's a good thing. I'm glad for that. I'm grateful for, you know, he's speaking at March for Life and that sort of thing. But, you know, I'm not fooled into thinking that this is evidence of some deep-seated, principled pro-life conviction on his part. You know, I think it's more of a sort of a calculated choice. And, there have been many things that he's said and done since taking office that, you know, do not show evidence of, Christian character, that things that are unkind, for which he hasn't repented. There was, of course, the whole Stormy Daniels payoff and whatnot. He even said publicly in one interview that he didn't see a particular need to repent for sins that he committed. So, I mean, he's a Hugh Hefner. He's a playboy, and always has been, still is, I think. And now, you know, has he still been sleeping about during his tenure in the White House? Well, you know, maybe not, because he's busy. You know, he's just got other things to be doing with his time. But, you know, that wouldn't be, again, that wouldn't be any great evidence of some sea change in his character. So I certainly disagree that we should be treating him as a brother in Christ. I see no evidence of that. And, you know, I've been kind of grieved in the past few years to see people try to work themselves up into seeing him that way, in order to kind of, you know, to make themselves feel better about this farce, essentially, is what it is. It really is a farce, you know. And that's not, I don't suffer from Trump derangement syndrome like some people do, but I think it's just simple fact that that's what this has become.
Yeah, it's like a kind of Constantinianism, isn't it?
Very much so, yeah.
You know, like God is finally sort of achieving his purposes through a political leader, isn't it?
Yeah, there's propaganda art that some people have drawn, like paintings that I'll see go up on Facebook from, you know, folks like Michael that paint the president in this sort of disturbing way. Like I saw one that it had a bunch of his Democrat enemies jumping up and down on an American flag, and then Trump is off to the side wearing some kind of military jacket and with his head bowed in prayer, and it's like this pious, blatant propaganda. That sort of thing really disturbs me, because it's not true. I don't think it's a reflection of the reality. I think the actual reality is far, you know, far colder and less feel good and more cynical, which again is not to say there haven't been gains. I mean, obviously I'm pleased with the recent appointment of Amy Coney Barrett. That was a bit of good news for many of us conservatives who've long opposed Roe, who think it's, you know, terrible constitutional law. Am I holding my breath that Roe versus Wade actually is going to be overturned now that Barrett is on the court? Not really. I think these things are really a coin toss, and even some of Trump's other appointees could easily still vote to uphold it. So, you know, when people point to those kinds of things, I say, yes, that's a good thing. I'm not denying that's a good thing, but just don't, you know, don't overinflate these things or pretend that they mean something they don't, you know?
Yeah. No, thank you for that. Tom, did you want to make any comments about any of this?
No, I'm content to let our expert speak. I think I certainly haven't seen any evidence of Trump proclaiming Christ in his life or in his actions or in his words. So I'd be very skeptical of that claim. I'm not sure quite what the best outcome of any election ever is, and especially this one where there's obviously, you know, Trump might be a force for good, God can use him, but then so could be Biden. And part of me wonders whether the best thing would be for the Republicans to go and think very carefully about the things that made Trump popular and try and find someone who isn't quite so divisive to carry that flag of, you know, smaller state, dealing with corrupt media, not giving in to wokeism, not having a balanced view on sort of crime and punishment and Black Lives Matters. You know, there are people out there who can speak the same sort of message, but maybe without the package of of Trump. And
yes.
Maybe four years in the wilderness is what they need to tune that. To find
yes.
That.
Yeah, well, that's a fascinating question. Again, I hate to sound cynical, though my mom said recently, she said, what I like about you is that you're cynical without being cynical. And I think what she meant was that it's the sort of, you know, wise as serpents, innocent as doves thing. But, you know, looking back at the sort of market appeal of Trump, so to speak, it's difficult to picture exactly what a candidate would look like who could break through the way that Trump did, minus the Trumpism. You know, I mean, like, He's sui generis, and certainly if you look at, I mentioned earlier this thing in the demographics, which is making liberals head spin, that he actually made gains with Black voters. It did much better with the Black demographic than Mitt Romney had before him. you know, people who live in their echo chamber go, I don't understand. I don't understand how this happened. And I'm looking at it, I go, it's obvious how it happened. You know, Mitt Romney was this sort of white bread, pasty, you know, Mormon guy. And Trump is like a rapper, essentially. I mean, you know, he's cool. He's flashy. He speaks in sound bites. You know, his Twitter stream is like a form of pop art unto itself, you know. And I mean, like, Romney couldn't do that. Mike Pence can't do that. I mean, who in the Republican Party is there who you know, who could catch that sort of lightning in a bottle? You know, I don't really know, but I despair at the thought that that's what it took. You know, it's so grotesque.
Yeah, I mean, he's I mean, there is a sense in which I think he's an amazing person. I mean, you know, like he. How does he have the level? I mean, there must be some level on which he is, you know, there's something unusual about his psychology, let's say. You know, he's so self-confident. I mean, he came from, you know, no political experience at all to being the president out of absolutely, you know, nothing really. I mean, obviously he's a billionaire, but, you know, and when you listen to people who are his aides, even people who dislike him, they say he has this kind of instinctive way of governing where, you know, they lay four options out and he just says, right, that one. And, you know, a lot of the time it seems like, you know, he makes really good decisions doing that. And I personally do think that a lot of good things have happened under the Trump presidency.
Yeah, and he's had help, clearly. I mean, you know, he's pretty ignorant. Like I was listening to a podcast with Douglas Murray recently where he mentioned this funny thing in John Bolton's new book, a story about how Trump was having an exchange with Theresa May, and she mentioned that Britain was a nuclear power, and he sort of stared blankly like, oh, you guys have nukes? It's like, he just didn't know. So it's, you know, there've been lots and lots of people clearly behind the scenes, you know, sliding things under his nose and sort of tapping his shoulder and saying, you might want to, you should probably sign this. So he's like, oh yeah, okay, sure. Yeah, I'll do that. You know? And so it's kind of amazing to watch, you know, how, like, in spite of his obvious ignorance, like you say, there's still a certain instinct there. Although I disagree with some things he's done, even in the areas like tariffs, for example. Like, I disagree with the strong imposition of tariffs. That's a whole separate discussion. But so anyway, yeah, it's very, very odd. And I remember at the time when he first won, I was excited about the bench of other Republican candidates because it seemed like an unusually deep and broad bench of talent, you know, with a number of other candidates I would have happily voted for. And yet, one by one, you could see each of them fail in his own sort of distinct way, and Trump was the only one left standing, you know. Yeah. I think if there is one broad lesson that the party could take away, it's that people do like a bar brawling kind of personality. You know, they like somebody who's unpredictable, you know, who's not just going to give standard boring stump speeches. You know, somebody who's willing to kind of take the gloves off and have a bit of fun. Yeah. So, yeah. You know, I've no idea what they'll do with that going forward, but, you know, I do think the entertainment value of Trump can't be discounted here.
No, this is indeed the end for Trump, and who would predict that it actually is? But if it is, then it has been incredibly entertaining for everyone, I think.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, I guess just to bring it back to theology for a moment, I guess the thing is for me is the thing I'm most wary of in Michael's email is the almost conflation of Christianity with the state. You know, mm-hmm. I'm very influenced by Augustine, you know, and the argument he makes in The City of God that, which obviously is an incredibly influential argument, you know, the church is a pilgrim. It's a pilgrim city that is traveling through this world, but it's in the world, but it's not of the world. It doesn't belong to the world. Whereas the pagan state is fundamentally unjust because it doesn't give God the worship which is due his name, it is temporary. It's passing away, and it might appear to be the highest reality because of the way things seem at the moment. But it's not. And indeed, you know, that the highest reality ultimately is God. But God works out His purposes through the church and in the world, which endures through empires and through administrations and so on. Yeah, I mean, I think we should probably wrap things up because we've been talking for ages. But Esther, this was, you know, this was meant to be a US special, and we're supposed to be talking about, you know, the next 4 years and who the president is going to be. But we honestly don't know. But it's been so good having you on. And, you know, I hope you'll come back when it's clearer who the president is, and maybe we can discuss that when that happens.
Yes, yes. And, you know, like Tom was saying, I'm not even sure exactly how to, what to hope for. I mean, because you know, in certain respects, I can see why a Trump win would be preferable, just in certain pragmatic terms. But then on the other hand, it's like, oh, great, you know, four more years of Christians psyching themselves out for this fellow, you know, it's just, you know. Either way, I'm just not super thrilled about the outcome, and so I'm just kind of, you know, just going to go about my day and check the news in the morning.
Well, that sounds like, I mean, at least you'll stay sane that way.
Exactly, yeah. Well, it's 2020, we need to.
Absolutely. Hey, Tom, before we finish, is there anything else that you wanted to bring up? Any other current issues or anything you wanted to flag up?
Nothing immediately, Jamie. There's plenty to talk about, as always, and as I said the other day, that when we were chatting, you know, it seems to be that current affairs are always overtaking us, because there are loads of stuff, I think, around the ethics of our coronavirus response that we need to talk about. And we, you know, I really want to talk about vaccinations actually at some point, but I mean, that's, you know, there's a whole issue around them, and some very worrying submissions to the government about the ethics of compulsory vaccination that I think we need to talk about. I think I said that before, though, didn't I? So maybe next week, but it's just too big a subject to sort of as an afterthought. But
I saw that submission as well. It was written by four academics where they're basically recommending compulsory vaccination on the basis of the legislation that's already been passed in order to justify the lockdown. And I mean, I agree with you. It chilled my blood reading it. Really did. We'll put that in the show notes for anyone who's interested. But this for me, you know, it opens up the whole question of what, you know, what is going to happen next with this coronavirus response. And I think it's absolutely vital that the church thinks about this and prepares itself for whatever's going to happen. So I think you're absolutely right there, Tom. But let's wrap it up for now. Esther, it's been so good having you on here. I've really enjoyed it. So thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great pleasure. Enjoyed the virtual cuppa.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it says on your Twitter profile that you're an Anglophile. So, you know, I'm glad that we could...
Hopeless Anglophile. Always have been, always shall be.
You must visit... Well, when you next visit England, Esther, maybe Jamie and I can take you to Cuddeston, where we trained, where there was a religious tea at 4 every day.
Oh, I hope so. Let's pray it's still open then. I hope so. Nice. I've never been. I've never been, but I want to someday. And now in the age of COVID, of course, it's uncertain exactly when that will happen. But one day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, our principal told us that, you know, when they were trying to make cuts, they were looking at their budget and they realized they were spending something like 10 grand a year on cake for those
two. Let's eat cake.
they took away the cake in the end, I think.
That's what I'm saying. It was just for that 4 o'clock thing. It wasn't just cake in general. The cake budget for the whole year was probably more like, you know, £500,000 or something, but just
for it
was 10 grand. So
I can't imagine it was 10 grand, Jeremy. The mind boggles.
Maybe it was five, but it was a lot of money. I'm not lying, okay? I'm a clerk in holy orders. Just to say for our listeners, do email irreverendpod@gmail.com for any feedback. I love getting your feedback. It's a real joy. So irreverendpod@gmail.com. And follow us on Twitter, which is @irreverendpod. It's all the same. And yeah, rate us on iTunes if you like the show. If you don't, you know, well, you can still rate us, but you know, if you like the show, please rate us and write a review, and that helps us helps other people to see us. Esther, what's your Twitter handle? Is it Esther of Riley? Is that right?
Yes, Esther of Riley, you know, House of so and so forth. And my blog is Young Fogey, where I wrote a couple of the pieces we've been discussing here. So yep, that's mainly where you can find me. Then I've outsourced things to different spots. I'm actually hoping to. I've promised Michael at the Critic magazine that I'm going to write something about the anniversary of Narnia. So hopefully I'll get that done. You can see that in next couple months or so.
Well, that would be a fascinating thing to talk to you about at some point. Yeah, and are you, Esther? Are you writing any books, or have you any plans to write any books?
Do I have plans to write any books? Like a novel maybe someday, but you know, who doesn't have a novel in them? But yeah, none immediately and currently, but later, who knows?
Yeah. Wow, watch this space.
Although I should say I do have so I do have an essay in an anthology of essays about Jordan Peterson called Myth and Meaning in Jordan Peterson. So I did contribute to that collection, and I may potentially in the future. I actually do have a contract that was offered to me to do an essay collection, but I didn't yet have enough material then. And then 2020 happened, and so you know, if I did write a book, the first thing I did would be a collection of, you know, some previously published and some new short material, but put between covers.
Yeah, well, that sounds great. We'll all be waiting for that with bated breath.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks everyone for listening to this episode. And yeah, please join us again and get in touch if you'd like to. And thank you so much. Thank you, Esther. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you very much, Jamie. Thank you, Esther.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Irreverent. Please join us again next time.